Can you believe we finally made it to Howie Winter and the race-fixing case?
It has been a long time coming.
And speaking of a long time, we need to tell our listeners that we're switching to a bi-weekly schedule.
Yes, between your work schedule and my research time, we neglect the website, social media, and so on.
And there's never enough time. And I have all these grand plans.
Hey, we have all these grand plans.
You know, I recorded that one solo episode, so I kind of forgot about you.
Well, thanks a lot.
I'm only joking. All right, one more thing. Besides our inconsistent sound quality issues, which we are working on, I want to know if our listeners prefer our bare-bones Spartan approach or if they would prefer intro music and suspense music throughout the episode. I'm hoping folks will give us some feedback in the comments section or by email.
Well, I prefer minimal. That's my vote.
Okay, and you know I am the of the nothing exceeds like excess school, so neither of us can be objective here. That's why I want them to answer, not us.
That is true. Okay, before we head to the races with Howie and the boys, we have a mailbag question. David wanted to know if we're going to talk about Howie's pinball case, which preceded the race-fixing case.
You know that it was at the Disabled American Vets Club where they were placing the pinball machines, right?
That's nice. The veterans were strong-arming the other vets.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
Okay, so Howie, Sal Sperlinga, and Herbie Foster conspired to maliciously threaten injury to Austin Griffin, manager of one of the DAVs, with bodily harm and destruction of property. And it wasn't just the DAV. They were also charged with threatening bodily harm to Arthur Agostinelli Sr. and destruction of property of his employer, Somerset Vending Company. Instead of accepting the threats, they went to the authorities, and that was the first major case that Howie faced. They were convicted in February of 1978. Howie was sentenced to 18 to 20 years. Sperlinga got 9 to 10, but remained free on bail pending an appeal. Herbie was acquitted. In June, Howie's attorneys applied for a sentence reduction, which was denied.
Hey, you left out the part about the investigation led by John Kerry into Howie's role in bribing the aldermen in Somerville to allow pinball machines after a 23-year ban.
How could I leave that out?
Well, you got to get John Kerry in there. Come on.
Okay.
The beginning of the end of the original Winter Hill, with Howie locked away, the last vestiges of Buddy McLean's version of that crew were erased, and Whitey and Stevie were ready to fill the void thanks to Special Agent Zip Connolly.
Connolly and the feds in general.
Yeah, well, I still think it was more than just Zip Connolly protecting the duo, but you have to figure that they, meaning the feds, needed Howie Winter off the street.
I agree, and sadly, I doubt we will find the answer in the throughs when we get them. Moving on from the pinball, let's give an overview of the race-fixing case, then unravel it by piecing together how the case came to be.
Okay. In February of 1979, Howie Winter and 20 others were charged with racketeering, sports bribery, and conspiracy in the fixing of thoroughbred horse races, thanks to Anthony Fat Tony Chula turning state's evidence in 1978. A 51-count indictment alleged that over $1 million was pocketed thanks to their efforts. The indictment was 54 pages long and listed six racetracks spread across Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania.
And seven of the men indicted were Howard T. Winter, James J. M. Moderano, both who were already in prison on other charges, two fugitives, Joe Mac McDonald and James Sims, Johnny Moderano, Melvin Goldenberg, Douglas Morello, Elliot Price, Richard Donati and his brother Bobby, Robert Owen, Sidney Tidsley, and Robert Duda. Jockeys, owners, and bookies were also indicted, but missing from the list were Whitey Bulger and Stevie Fleming.
I wonder why that was.
Keep your snarkiness in check.
Okay. Can I just start us off with a little history here? In December of 1966, FBI Special Agent Len Frizzoli retired after a 25-year career with the FBI. We covered his role in various high-profile crimes, including the 1950 Brinks heist, in other episodes, so I won't go over all of that again. You can check out those episodes in our catalog. The following month, Frizzoli got a job at Rockingham Park in Salem, New Hampshire, as Assistant Director of Operations. In 1971, McDowns was purchased by a company called Ogden Enterprises, and part of their overhaul included hiring Frizzoli's company to oversee security. Frizzoli's company also had contracts with the NFL, the NHL, Wonderland, Rockingham, Hinsdale, and the Taunton Dog Track.
So two of the six tracks tied to the race-fixing scheme. It's interesting that one Fed who was tasked with bringing these guys down ended up heading security for the tracks, and another retired agent, H. Paul Rico, found himself wrapped up with High Line and essentially employed by the very men he was previously tasked with locking up.
And we will hear all about that later in the season.
Oh yeah, we will. Okay, back to the matter at hand. In 1971, the Rhode Island Attorney General and the Massachusetts Attorney General had announced a joint investigation into race fixing through doping, describing the criminal practice as widespread throughout New England. And evidently, that announcement had a negative effect on attendance at Suffolk Downs, and in turn, revenue took a nosedive, a six-figure dip, no less.
At the end of that year, 30 people were subpoenaed to testify in front of the grand jury in January of 72, and none other than Laura's favorite storyteller, Vinnie Teresa, was the state's star witness.
Of course he was.
He told the same story he had during his Senate testimony the year before, that the horses were given tranquilizers or speed, depending upon the desired outcome of the race. Vinnie's testimony, along with others, led to 16 secret indictments later that month.
And Vinnie wasn't the only habitual liar to add his 2 cents. Your favorite, Joe Barboza, testified in May of 72. Once again, he went after Henry Tamelio, like what he and the feds did to Henry wasn't enough with the Teddy Deegan case.
Hey, Barboza obviously had it in for poor Henry, but I'd really like to know if it was something tangible or if it was just some childish perceived slight on Barboza's part.
I'm sure it was some whacked out BS thing. Barboza testified that Tamelio told him that the mafia owned about 50% of the horses that ran in New England, as if Tamelio was going to waste his breath explaining that to him. Was there anything on the wiretap of the Coin-O-Matic about the races?
Good question. Off the top of my head, I can't recall, but obviously that would have been a decade before.
True, I was just curious. Anyhow, it wasn't just the wise guys who were being investigated. Plymouth County Assistant DA was charged also. I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but he was indicted along with Tamelio, Salvatore Macarelli, William Barnowski, and Anthony Chula.
That guy was wrapped up in trying to discredit another candidate. There were hookers and all sorts of soap opera worthy stuff there.
No shortage of drama. There was a jockey on the lam in Florida who refused to testify. When he was finally scooped up, he said that he would fight the extradition to Massachusetts.
Fast forward to May of 72, Robert Byrne became the government's key witness in the trial. He testified that Barnowski had told him to pick up $1,000 from an attorney in Brockton. After he had done so, he went back to Barnowski's and was given $800 and 2 syringes filled with some kind of drug that he said looked like castor oil. Barnowski then instructed Byrne to go to Suffolk Downs to oversee the doping of 2 horses and to pay the guys off. Frizzoli's team had really tightened up security by that time and was keeping track of everyone coming and going. So, of course, everything went sideways when Byrne tried to sneak into Suffolk Downs and got picked up for trespassing. Byrne said he was running late and missed his appointment with the trainer who was supposed to get him access to the stalls. And of course, the money and the syringes were on him and he had to use some of the cash to bail himself out.
I am restraining myself from my own snarkiness. The following month, 4 of the 5 defendants were convicted. Edward Nelson was fined $1,000. Barnowski, Macarelli, and Chula were sentenced to 1 year in jail. And Chula was on his way to becoming a future star witness for the government.
Chula had already been banned from Suffolk Downs, according to Frizzoli.
Well, that's true. Chula was banned from everywhere, pretty much.
The following summer, the Senate Committee on Organized Crime pushed forward with formalizing race fixing as a federal offense. Barboza's testimony was cited as part of why it was necessary. And don't start. We all know he was a liar.
Okay.
Emprise Corporation was also in the spotlight. And that's E-M as in Mary Prize. Just so everyone...
Isn't it kind of like... I was thinking that it was like a combination of empire and enterprise.
No, it's a real word. Actually, if you look it up in the dictionary, I didn't want to get into all of that, but it's actually a real, it means something, but now I can't remember what the, anyway. Because I was thinking enterprise, but it's not. It's
I was thinking like empire, and I don't know, so that's what I was thinking, but anyhow. Obviously, okay. We were both wrong.
Okay, well, it was founded by Louis Jacobs, and then after the passing of his sons, Jeremy and Max took over, and Louis passed away in 68, I think, so he was dead by this point, and they were out of Buffalo, New York.
Okay.
The corporation was involved in the sports industry, including food and concessions at racetracks and sports stadiums across the U.S. Emprise supposedly lent large sums of money to Berkshire Downs, which Raymond Patriarca allegedly had a large stake in before it went bankrupt. They were also involved in High Lie, so they'll definitely be making an appearance again when we do that episode, and there'll be way more detail then.
Mm-hmm. Since we're giving an abbreviated history of the racetracks, let's also talk about what Howie was up to besides pushing pinball machines onto the vets.
Hey, we never do anything abbreviated.
Well, this is true. So, since we are giving a long-winded history instead of an abbreviated one, in the summer of 1973, the DA's office opened an investigation into Howie's role in a case involving the Boston Housing Authority and Chandler's Restaurant in the South End. The building where Chandler's was located was owned by Howie and Jimmy Mutterano. The property was previously owned by the Housing Authority.
Hey, the description of Jimmy Mutterano in the Globe was great. He blends in well with doctors, lawyers, architects, and the public officials who frequent Chandler's.
Can we stick to the matter at hand, please?
Okay. Mutterano told reporters that Howie was a legitimate businessman who he knew for years who had never been to prison.
Yeah, but Jimmy was in the cooler already for being an accessory after the fact.
And it wouldn't be long before he'd be heading back there.
And we didn't cover the loan shark cases.
Hey, we have to do that before we move on.
All right, well, let's schedule it for our next episode.
I want to just wrap up the Chandler saga. It burnt down on June 18th, 1975.
There were actually two separate fires just a few days apart.
Well, they didn't get it right the first time, so
yeah, well,
you know, back and do it again, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, just to loop this back around to the Blackfriars, one of the allegations made against Jack Kelly and his associations with Winter Hill was that he aided Jimmy Mutterano in clearing out the alcohol from the building a few days before it burned down. But Kelly said he was just observing, not helping.
Well, he couldn't waste all that good booze. Years later, they were still investigating the fires, but could never make a case. That wasn't the only investigation. Howie had a different sort of vet situation on his hands. He and his two sons were subpoenaed along with 47 others by the Suffolk Grand Jury in August of 1974. His son Gary was a former Marine and Junior was an Army reservist at the time. They were implicated in a scam to defraud the VA of over $1 million in bogus claims using real and fake names to fraudulently obtain bennies. Howie took the fifth and refused to testify. By the end of the month, 19 in total were indicted, including Howie's son Gary. The case would drag out until early 1976.
Okay, we already talked about the pinball case, so now we can finally get back to the subject of today's episode. As we mentioned earlier, Anthony Chula had been sentenced to a year in the can in 1972 on the race-fixing charges from the doping case at Suffolk Downs. What no one but the authorities would know until the damage was done was that Chula had been cooperating since July of 75 when he was arrested in New Jersey after a jockey wearing a wire set him up in a sting operation.
The authorities and Whitey Bulger and Stevie Flemmy knew.
Well, that is true, and Chula's undoing would prove to be the undoing of the Winter Hill crew that Howie inherited from Buddy McLean.
I still believe that Howie wasn't invited to the Connolly-Whitey party because he was aligned with Jerry and Julo.
Okay, you can share your theory at the end, but tell us how and why Fat Tony flipped.
Okay, a jockey named Christopher Landcini was caught holding a horseback in the ninth race on July 4th, 1975 in Atlantic City. When questioned, Landcini gave up Chula and said it was a regular thing for Chula to pay off jockeys to hold a horse back. While Landcini was being grilled, his agent, Louis Mena, was being scooped up for writing bad checks. In exchange for wearing a wire and getting Fat Tony on tape, the charges would be dropped and Landcini and Mena were happy to oblige the authorities. On the night of July 16th, 1975, Landcini met Chula at his New Jersey hotel room, and he was wired for sound.
And the locals sat in their car recording it all. So Chula's freedom was cut short, but he wasn't just facing conspiracy charges in New Jersey. He was also facing charges of race fixing at Lincoln Downs in Rhode Island in 1971, along with Barnowski. The charges had been brought against Fat Tony and 20 others the month before. Plus, he was under investigation by the Pennsylvania State Police for the same offense. On August 6th, Tony, his favorite partner in crime Barnowski, George Shipp, and John, how do you say this
last name? Salvaggio.
Were indicted by a New Jersey grand jury. And like magic, the FBI swooped in and made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
Have you ever watched any of the Godfather movies, one or two?
No.
You so have to. Okay. As for Anthony, in exchange for a reduced sentence, followed by a new identity in the witness protection program and immunity from future charges, he would testify at grand jury hearings and the trials of his partners in crime. In October, the Rhode Island DA's office sought to have Chula and Barnosky's bail revoked because of the New Jersey case. By then, Rhode Island had bail conditions that included staying out of trouble.
What a novel idea.
Can you imagine? In January, the Rhode Island court ordered the men to begin serving 5 years each for the Lincoln Downs case, but obviously Chula would escape that fate. It wouldn't be until 1977 that the public would learn that he was telling all.
The guys that hadn't been charged yet had to have been waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Everyone except Whitey and Stevie.
Hey, I knew you were going to go there.
Creature of habit. Back to the first round of indictments, openly attributed to Fat Tony, a.k.a. Tony Rossi, and Joseph Rossi, or he was better known as Anthony Chula. 12 men, including one who was an active naval officer, had taken some $50,000 worth of payoffs from Chula, and they were charged with bribery and race fixing that took place from December of 1974 to April of 1975. They were all jockeys, trainers, and exercise boys.
Hey, you always have to have a Navy guy in the mix.
Yeah, and a BC guy. In January of 1978, the story about Landicini and Chula hit the papers along with the New Jersey indictments. Howie and Jimmy Mutterano were in the can, so they were just sitting and waiting. Joe Mack and Sims were on the lam, but I'm sure if Joe Mack could have gotten his hands on Chula, he would have choked the life out of him.
I bet. In October of 78, the trial was underway in New Jersey. Sports Illustrated ran a huge piece on the race-fixing scheme. All of the jockeys accused, charged, or otherwise denied any involvement with Chula. In the beginning of November, Chula fingered Howie on the stand. Then on November 6th, Howie Winter was named as the, quote, brains behind the operation, unquote, during the Ellen Brogna appeal. Brogna, Howie's future bride, was accused of allowing Howie to use the phone in her Somerville apartment to conduct his illegal activities.
I have so much to say, but I'm going to bite my tongue.
Hey, save it for later. The accusations leveled by Chula had remained a secret up until his testimony in New Jersey.
Brogna was being held in contempt for refusing to testify. Her lawyer confirmed Chula's testimony and told the court that Winter and Mutterano were targets of the grand jury.
Chula gave detailed testimony to the grand jury about how the variety of scams worked. All of the schemes, regardless of the track, followed a particular pattern. The plotting and planning took place far from the track since Chula and his alleged right-hand man, Robert Owen, were banned from every racetrack east of Mississippi. And soon the public would hear the whole tale.
As we mentioned at the beginning, the indictments were handed down on February 5, 1979. The following week, Howie was arraigned. He pleaded the fifth during the pretrial hearing, refusing to answer any questions about his life circumstances prior to his conviction in the pinball case for which he was serving an 18-year sentence. Former DA Arthur Garrity recused himself because he had been involved in the investigation prior to becoming a judge.
According to the indictment, Joe Mack and Jimmy Sims were responsible for ensuring that Chula had cash whenever he needed it to pay bribes and place bets. Johnny Mutterano was the bookkeeper, and Jimmy Mutterano laundered the money through his businesses.
What a neat and tidy story.
Hey, I know you're trying to get your theory off your chest.
I think Whitey cooked up the story with Stevie to get Howie out of the way and keep the Mutterano brothers in check. They told the tale to Connolly, and he loved it because Howie was aligned with Jerry Angiulo, just as Buddy McLean was prior to his slaying. The Fed's main goal was to knock the Italians out of the box, so everyone was happy with this situation. Connolly and company then fed the story to Chula from the time they flipped him until they trotted him out to the grand jury. By then, Chula told the story as if it was his very own, the same thing that I believe that they did with Valachi in the early 1960s.
And Vinnie Teresa, and Joe Barboza, and Jack Kelly, and Peter Auver, and every other guy they put on the stand over the decades.
No question about it. In total, 21 people were indicted. Richard Donati pleaded guilty before the trial even began. Two men from Philly had their cases transferred to Pennsylvania, where they pleaded guilty as well. Meanwhile, Johnny Mutarano, Joe Mack, Jimmy Sims, and Barnosky were all following Sonny Mercurio's advice about the power of the lamb.
You love that quote.
Hey, I am making merch with that emblazoned on it.
Hey, I want a trucker hat.
That'd be cool.
Jury selection began on April 30th with the judge deciding not to sequester the jury. I'm sure the jurors were thankful since the case was scheduled to last 10 weeks with 51 counts against 12 of the defendants, including racketeering, sports bribery, and conspiracy.
It would be bad enough being cooped up and isolated from your world for 10 weeks, but to top it off, a huge chunk of your time would be spent listening to Chula.
No, thank you. That's why you avoid jury duty at all costs.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
Less than 2 weeks into the trial, Robert Duda pleaded guilty in exchange for a 4-year sentence. His was the 6th guilty plea. Bobby Donati, like his brother, had already pleaded guilty. Bobby was looking at a 135-year prison sentence given the 23 counts he was charged with. Duda stood accused of beating up a jockey outside of Pocono Downs, but the prosecution agreed to drop that charge, too.
Hey, the guy who was busy slapping around jockeys was the alleged mastermind behind the Gardner heist, according to many.
Hey, I know it's a bone in your throat, but save that for when we get to the Gardner.
I'm moving on. A few days after Duda and Bobby pleaded out, Chula testified that in August of 1974, he had bribed a trainer to lose a specific race at Pocono Downs. The trainer was told not to place a bet on that race that he knew the future outcome of, but in true degenerate fashion, Chula saw the trainer betting on the race anyway. Chula claimed he called Howie for instructions. Winter said he should get banged around to teach them a lesson down there, Chula testified. He told the jury that instead of doing the job himself, he had delegated to Barnosky, Duda, and Bobby Donati. Then three men had gone overboard and split open their victim's head, quote, like a cantaloupe, unquote.
What a trio. The following month, a jockey who Chula bribed to throw the race didn't hold up his end of the bargain, and Chula again called upon his trustworthy trio, Duda, Barnosky, and another man to, quote-unquote, rough up the jockey. This time, Chula testified, they beat and kicked the jockey until he was unconscious, breaking his ribs and whatever. They said they didn't know how bad he was hurt, but he was motionless when they left him.
Chula then testified about an instance in October of 1974. He claimed another jockey agreed to hold his horse back for a payment of $800, this time at Suffolk Downs. But he won the race instead, leading Howie to threaten the jockey with murder after he and Barnosky beat him up at a cafe in Somerville.
Well, Chula did testify about how his relationship with Howie began.
Do tell.
Oh, you'll like this. Chula said that he met Howie for the first time at Chandler's in the South End in 73. Chula had beat one of Howie's bookies out of $5,000 by betting on a race that he himself had put the fix in on. Howie ordered Chula to pay the earnings back to the bookie. Then, like magic, they met a few months later at a bar in Somerville, and Howie had a business proposition for him.
Sure, go on.
The business agreement saw Chula continuing his race fixing, but with Howie financing the bribes to the jockeys, trainers, and exercise boys. And to give Chula access to all the bookies working under Howie's protection. In return, Chula and Howie became 50-50 partners.
The one and only Elliot Price of the Riviera in Vegas, who was also a defendant, testified that he met Howie for the first time in Vegas in the winter of 72. Howie was part of a gambling junket for high rollers who had a credit line of $10,000 or more. During the encounter, Howie invited Price to dine at Chandler's if he was ever in Boston.
Hey, Chandler's was a happening spot.
Yeah, I guess it was. And like magic, a few months later, Price just happened to be in Boston having a nosh at Chandler's when Howie turned up. Fast forward to November 30th, 1974. Chula was at the Riviera and lost a $5,000 credit line of credit and was seeking additional gambling funds. When Chula hadn't paid the money back to the Riviera, Price claimed he had called Howie to urge him to repay the debt.
Chula testified that Price and another casino executive and defendant, Morris Golding, each had given him $100,000 in proceeds from the race-fixing scheme, although Price repudiated the claim. Chula, meanwhile, denied ever using Howie's name in order to secure the credit line at the Riviera. The cross-examination of Chula began in the middle of May, when the defense asked him if he was a thief previously convicted of possessing stolen property. Chula answered in the affirmative and pointed to Howie and the boys and said, quote, "And those are my partners," unquote.
They must have loved that. He told the court that he was afraid of returning to Rhode Island as he believed he would be killed. Howie's lawyer asked him about the condition of one of the jockeys who had supposedly been beaten. Chula said that he didn't appear to have been beaten badly, but there was a little blood on the corner of his mouth. When questioned about his previous statements given to DA Jeremiah O'Sullivan, Chula admitted to providing the DA with erroneous dates and times about some of the alleged incidents. Chula quipped to the attorney, Cullen, "If you want to say I made a mistake about the time, you're probably right." Cullen replied, "You could be wrong about a lot of things," to which Chula replied, "Not about your client."
Another person to testify was a Pennsylvania state trooper, Eugene Mahalik. He was part of the surveillance team in the motel room next to Chula and Owen's room. From his vantage point, he could hear them chatting on the phone and conversing with each other and visitors. At Pocono Downs, he observed Duda with a stack of $3 betting slips that was, as the trooper described, the size of a loaf of bread. He held up the line for 15 minutes, placing his bets. As we mentioned earlier, Duda pleaded guilty before the start of the trial, claiming he was a runner for Chula.
Did anyone else besides Chula actually testify directly against Howie?
Not that I saw, but that reminds me. I want to backtrack for just a minute. We touched on this when we covered the murder of Richie Castucci, but Chula testified that Howie planned to use his illicit winnings as a down payment to buy the Squire Lounge in 75. Jimmy Moderano was also meant to be involved, but the deal didn't get off the ground. Castucci bought the lounge instead and was killed by Winter Hill the following year.
And that confirms my theory. They were trying to put the heat on Howie for Castucci's murder in order to protect Whitey and Stevie.
Well, I wouldn't say confirm, but it definitely makes it seem highly likely. The 10-week-long trial came to an end with guilty verdicts delivered against Howie and Jimmy Moderano, along with five other defendants, on July 11, 1979. Howie was sentenced to 10 years in prison.
Just days after Howie was convicted, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Pennsylvania unsealed a 27-count indictment against 21 more individuals regarding race fixing at Pocono Downs in 1974. The indictments were kept secret at the request of the judge in Boston. Howie and Chula were named as unindicted co-conspirators. According to the charges, Howie had financed the race fixing, but more importantly, in the summer of 74, he had allowed Angelo Boffolino to participate in the scheme.
Hey, he had to get all the big names in there.
I'm surprised there weren't more of them. It would be four more years before our favorite Lannister, Joe Mack and Jimmy Sims, would be caught. The duo pleaded guilty in January of 1983 and were each sentenced to 6 years the following month. If you want to hear more about that, listen to the Hit Parade of 1976.
Howie appealed and took his case all the way to the Supreme Court, but they refused to hear the case in March of 83. He wouldn't regain his freedom until May of 85, when he was granted parole from Leavenworth. His Marine buddy, Billy Gingras, who owned an auto body shop in Millbury, vouched for him and gave him a job.
The same Gingras whose shop was located just minutes away from Jake Tarzian of Bonded Vault fame and where he was living and slain a little over 2 months later.
The one and only, who also had a box in a storage bin that the authorities raided, which contained 3 machine guns, 6 shotguns, 4 rifles, 15 handguns, and 60 rounds of ammo, all of which Gingras claimed was given to him unbeknownst by the late Jake Tarzian.
There's always a thread or sometimes even an entire ball of yarn tying all these stories together. And on that note, let's wrap this up. There will be more of Howie in future episodes, and hopefully by then the feds will have sent us something.
Yeah, but I am not holding my breath on the value of it.
Oh, likewise. All right. Thanks everyone for listening as always. And we will be back in 2 weeks with the Loan Shark case of 75 and actually covering most of the 70s. And I can't blame you, Nina, for keeping us in the 70s this time.
No, you can't.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Bye.